Ladies and gentlemen, to a very special episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, where we have a guest in studio. His name is Arik Rees. He's the maker of the upcoming documentary film Drug Lord, which is spelled L-A-W-E-D. So it's www.druglord.com. And he's basically needing a whole lot of pledges and DVD pre-sales and things of that nature in order to get the documentary film finished right here in New Zealand. Arik, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Vinny.
Well, tell us a little bit about the doco, what you do, who you are, you know, for those who don't know.
Sure. It started in 2009 in the middle of a riot where I was in Dunedin, and one of the Undy 500 riots had gone completely out of control, and there was about 2,000 or 3,000 students throwing bottles at the cops. And there was another set of cops just a few blocks away harassing the stoners who were peacefully engaging them and trying to educate them. And this contradiction between the alcohol laws and the cannabis laws became just too stark for me to ignore. So I turned my documentary filmmaking skills to investigate New Zealand's cannabis laws. And almost 4.5 years on, I'm nearly finished the epic documentary Drug Lord, how New Zealand Green got rolled up in the U.S. drug war.
Well, what's your conclusion based upon the law itself? I mean, do we have old-school drug laws like they did back in the 60s where you go for years for like 5 grams or something? Or,
well, New Zealand has the highest arrest and conviction rate of any country in the entire world when it comes to cannabis. Sorry, I forgot to turn off my phone.
It's an item.
Hang on.
Isn't it interesting, the drug lord documentary filmmaker who's in high demand?
Okay, sorry about that, folks. What was your question, Vinny?
We were talking about in terms of how you relate the intensity of the drug laws. Like, I've seen people in the United States with, getting their hands bound around their back, the three strikes law and all of that kind of stuff. New Zealand's not that bad to people, is it?
Oh, it actually is. You find, especially to minority groups, Maori and Pacific Islanders. what happens is your likelihood of being arrested is pretty high in New Zealand. In fact, the highest in the world for cannabis. You may be let off leniently. That is true. You may get home detention. You may get a fine, etc., etc. However, your record will be permanently blighted by this completely unnecessary conviction that you will receive. And it's a conviction for a victimless crime. It's not even a crime. To call it a victimless crime is to say that it's a crime of some kind. Mm. But there's no victim. And if there's no victim, then there's no crime. It's as simple as that.
Well, there's no damage to persons or their property. Therefore, it's not unlawful, right?
Correct. Correct. Who's the complainant? Who's complaining against you if you get arrested for cannabis? The state is the complainant. Have you harmed the state in any way? The only harm you've done to the state is thumb your nose at their authority, which is your right as a citizen if the state is in the wrong. So in actual fact, it's a rights issue. You have the right to take whatever intoxicant you choose as long as it doesn't affect anybody else around you. That is your natural right as a human being, particularly when it comes to medication, which is another issue of this entire cannabis debate, that a lot of people are not taking it recreationally. It's a matter of life and death for many of these people.
Mm.
And the state is denying your right to access medicine that you need.
Mm. Well, you'd have a look at some of those individual cases of people like, Billy McKee, who runs Green Cross New Zealand, leg taken off by a drunk driver.
Exactly.
The only thing that actually helps with the pain without ridiculously psychoactive side effects that turns him into a horrible husband and father is cannabis, which keeps him calm and also relieves him of all the pain. And the secondary use that he has for it, I found particularly interesting, is raw cannabis bud simply tapered onto his stump, which normally gets a lot of irritation if he's walking around, and it takes away the irritation and some of the inflammation.
That's been known for hundreds of years, actually. The cannabis leaves were used to bandage wounds in China 3,000 years ago. That's what they were being used for, to reduce inflammation. Corn plasters were being made out of cannabis 100 years ago to reduce inflammation. It's the same principle. So we've got this natural medicine, which you can produce free, which you don't have to go to the healthcare system for and, you know, impose costs on the taxpayer. But you're not allowed to grow it. You're not allowed to produce it. You're not allowed to possess it. You're not allowed to trade in it. So we've got a total prohibition in New Zealand. It is illegal in New Zealand to possess a single seed of cannabis, unless it's a hemp seed, and there are only 4 people licensed to grow hemp seeds, to grow hemp in this country.
Well, the power to license is the power to take away.
Exactly.
Why do we need licenses? I mean, where's the danger in hemp? I mean, well, there is a danger, but here's the thing. There's 2 perspectives on this. Are you a psychopath who loves making money and loves hurting people? No, you're not. So you wouldn't understand why the drug laws are the way they are. If you were, on the other hand, one of those people, that'd make total sense to you, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Our drug laws exist to keep the drug warriors in business. And the side effect is that you're keeping the real drug lords, the real gangs who are dealing in drugs, in business as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the primary reason we have drug laws in this country is because it services the needs of the drug warriors.
Who are these drug warriors?
The number one drug warrior is Peter Dunn.
Oh, yeah.
Who, am I allowed to say Peter Dunhill Stuyvesant? Is he
sponsored by the tobacco industry?
There is a lot of evidence to indicate that he is, and I haven't gone through his voting record with a fine-tooth comb yet, but I have seen consistencies in his voting which indicate that whenever there's a decision to be made in Parliament, Dunn always favors the tobacco companies. In the ones that I've investigated, he consistently votes for the tobacco companies' interests.
Pay the piper, call the tune, as it were.
Exactly. I'll give you one example. When the ban on indoor smoking in certain areas was proposed, Dunn was dead set against that. He said it's an impingement on the rights of companies to sell their product in a free market system. Doesn't matter that the product being sold is the deadliest drug in the world, by far the deadliest drug in the world.
And cannabis is like 87th,
It's not on the deadly list, because it's never, as far as all the scientists and doctors that I've interviewed during the course of this last 4.5 year shoot, have all told me it's caused 0 deaths that they know of. So there might be, who knows, there might be 10 deaths. There might be 5 deaths a year. Let's be generous and say there's 5 deaths from cannabis a year. Well, that's still 6.5 million less than die of cigarettes every year.
Mm, and you're talking globally?
Globally, yes.
Okay. 6.5 million deaths versus 5. Keep the baccy legal and axe it up with 700 chemicals, which are dangerous and known carcinogens.
Yes.
Were people dying of lung cancer before they started adding all these additives and things like that to regular pipe tobacco and stuff like that? I wonder.
Well, I've often thought that. I haven't researched it, but if you take the tobacco leaf straight off the of the tobacco plant, which you can do, and roll it up and smoke it straight away, or dry it and smoke it without adding anything, it's reasonable to assume that the same kinds of diseases that result from the adulterated tobacco, which most people smoke, won't result from somebody smoking pure tobacco.
Mm. Well, can I also make an observation? Because what it seems to me be is that many people might grow tobacco because we've tobacco is legal in this country. You can mm-hmm. grow it. Mm-hmm. I've tried it myself, and it's ridiculously difficult to get the seeds to germinate. Mm-hmm. And depending on the climate, sometimes they don't grow at all. And it also takes an awful long time to dry, mm-hmm. and it's meticulous to cut it. It's a lot of effort. Most people will not go through that kind of effort.
That is true.
So, and that's a legal drug that anybody can grow for free. I presume the same would be for cannabis. There would still be a larger buyer's market than there would be a grower's market because it's a lot of effort, isn't it?
It is an effort to grow decent cannabis. There would be still a number of people who want to buy it, and therefore we do need to regulate the production of it because it is a drug. It may be one of the least addictive and least harmful drugs out there, but it is still a drug, and therefore it needs regulations and controls so that kids don't get it, which they're doing now, so that people aren't misusing it, and that those people who are having a problem with it, well, they can seek recourse to get help without interdiction from the criminal justice system.
And are there other case studies of places where they have treatment programs and things of that nature for people who are, you know, just so whacked out on cannabis that it's destroying their life? They can go to mm-hmm. this place, detox, and suss it out.
Here in New Zealand,
or anywhere.
Well, the luminary examples are Portugal and the Netherlands. Portugal decriminalized all drugs across the board in 2000. What they found there was that drug use decreased by half, crimes associated with drugs decreased by half, diseases associated with drugs decreased by half, and the overall cost to society decreased by half. So it was a massive win. And the problem there was that they were getting resistance from the United Nations and from America, who were saying, no, you cannot decriminalize drugs, because we have to be committed to the drug war and the program of suppressing drugs through the criminal justice system. And, of course, they just turned around and said, no, this is costing us too much. We have the highest drug rate use in Europe. We're going to decriminalize, and we will assess the situation. Well, 10 years on, it's been a complete victory. You know, they've succeeded in every single facet that they intended to succeed. So what does that tell you? I mean, why is the rest of the world still plodding down the road to ruin with the drug war?
Ki bono, who benefits? I do know that the CIA runs huge quantities of heroin around the world. Is there also a cannabis element to that
well?
In any realms of officialdom, organized crime, etc., that may be currently involved with cannabis that do not want it legalized and regulated because, hey, then the price would drop drastically, wouldn't it?
That's true. That's not strictly true. What you'd have is a high excise tax to keep the price pretty constant because you don't want the price to fall too much, otherwise use will increase. You don't want to create a situation where everybody's high on cannabis all the time because it's so readily available and so cheap. So to keep the price consistent, you have a high excise tax. What's the purpose of that high excise tax? Well, you take that money and you put it in the health system. And all the people who do present problems, which won't be very many, but those people that do require help or intervention, well, they have this huge pool of money to draw from, and they're not causing any costs to any other part of society. The cannabis users are paying for the problems of the cannabis users. Whereas today, you've got the entire country paying for the problems of the alcoholics, paying for the problems of the people dying from tobacco-related illnesses, and people dying from pharmaceutical problems as well. Those are the three most dangerous classes of drugs, and they're all legal.
I would act under the assumption that if a medical patient was capable of growing their own cannabis, it would be much less a drain on any health system, regardless. I mean, the savings for treating somebody with multiple sclerosis or glaucoma or cancers and things of that nature
would
be astronomical.
That's true.
You could practically shut down half the health system.
Well, here's the thing. If people were actually advised to eat raw bud, which has no psychoactive effects, it's purely a boost to your immune system, and it has ameliorative effects on a number of diseases. And it seems to have preventative effects on a number of diseases. So if you were to eat raw cannabis every day, you'd probably not experience any of the health problems that we're experiencing so commonly in society today.
Now, there's also hemp seed as well, which is
superfood.
You know,
it can live on it.
Well, quite literally, I believe there was a town in northern Australia, around Darwin or something of that nature, that went through an enormous drought for a number of years, and the only thing they had to eat was hemp seed, and they were fine.
Hemp seed and water. That's all you need to live.
Mm.
And furthermore, I mean, the hemp seed itself, it can be pressed and made into oil for salads, for example. It can be made into oil for your skin, for your lips, for your hair. We made into shampoo, soap, etc. So if you have one single plant, you know, that you can farm, it should be hemp because you can make food. You can make building materials. You can make dynamite, cellophane. You can make 50,000 things from it that are currently being produced at a huge economic cost and carbon cost by oil-based products.
Okay. Well, the other element here is also every establishment that has existed throughout history has fought tooth and nail to prevent its own demise, right?
That's true.
So what's happening here, I believe, with cannabis is not only are you threatening, say, black ops budgets, because if you're turning it legal, sure, people can still make money off it, but it's got to be money on the books. If you've got money off the books, that's cash for any operations you want.
Absolutely.
And so there's a threat there to whatever skullduggery and scumbaggery is going on within intelligence services or whatever. There's an incentive for them to sell and ship and distribute the drugs themselves.
That's right.
And the other establishments are, of course, if there's 50,000 industrial products, that means there must be 50,000 different forms of industry that would either have to adapt or simply wouldn't survive.
Well, they would have competition that they currently do not have, most notably the oil companies, because you think that you're paying however many dollars at the pump. What you're paying is that plus the subsidies that are being drawn from, you know, the public's coffers and given to these oil companies, which is a massive thing in the United States. Half the cost of oil is borne by the taxpayer, half the cost of gasoline, I should say. So people think that that hemp or hemp-based biofuels can't compete in price. But in actual fact, if you remove those oil subsidies, they're equivalent in price at a negative up or something. Zero. For the fuel, it's a zero carbon cost for building materials, negative carbon cost.
Right. Arik Reese, maker of the documentary Drug Lord at druglord.com. That's Drug Lord with a W. We'll be right back after the break. TheNewsShow.com.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream. Just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president it seemed. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy, according to John Key, because now everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest is Arik Reese, and the maker of the documentary film DrugLord.com. That's law as in the one that suppresses you. Arik, what were we talking about just before we got off to a break there is the different beneficiaries of the drug laws being where they are, financial and also power grabbing, I found is very interesting.
Oh, yes.
You've got the ability to search people without warrants, and if they find something, hey, it doesn't matter if they violated your rights in order to get it. Hey, we found something.
Correct. The search and surveillance bill that was passed recently in New Zealand, it has the drug laws woven into it. The police can kick down your door to search for drugs. They could search your car, your person. They can't do that for a stolen TV.
Mm.
So for the police, it might not even be so much about the drug laws so much as the powers that it grants them to do general policing. And if they net people for drugs, well, that's just great for them because it's overtime. You know, it's an easy bust a lot of the time. You don't want to be running after some burglar in the middle of the street trying to chase down an actual criminal when you can just roll a pothead who's not going to resist you and, you know, who's going to be a little naughty badge on your report card so that you can move up the chain of command.
Yeah. Well, can I also make an observation? Does that make police, in a lot of senses, just kind of cowards? They don't actually want to put themselves in danger in order to make society safer. They'd rather hurt people who really have never hurt anybody else, not even themselves, if then, and they'd rather spend their time doing that?
Well, I'd agree with that. I think the days of people being drawn to the police force because they are brave and they are honorable and they want society to be a better place, I think those days are over because of the selection process that's involved.
Could you explain the selection process?
Well, when you apply for a job at the police force, they're going to exclude you if you have any involvement in drugs whatsoever. So if you have actually any contact with drugs, any personal experience with drugs, and therefore a deeper knowledge of what drugs do to you, you'll be automatically excluded. So what you're left with is a pool of people who essentially they hate drug users. Of course, that's a double standard because they've got nothing against drug users who are using alcohol, drug users who are using tobacco, and drug users who are using pharmaceuticals. It's the ones that they're programmed to dislike, principally cannabis. There are other drugs as well, you know, but cannabis is by far the main illicit drug used not only in New Zealand, across the world. So if you legalize cannabis, the problem shrinks by about 75% overnight. The drug problem that's perceived to exist in society because people are using illegal drugs. And, of course, they ignore the fact that there's a drug problem in society which is far more deadly. It's the legal drug problem, but let's just look at the illicit drugs. Take out cannabis from the equation. The drug problem diminishes to negligible size. The number of people using meth, cocaine, heroin, all of these other drugs that are actually deadly and are corrosive to your body, it's a minute number of people. You wouldn't be able to justify the billion-dollar budgets, well, multi-million-dollar budgets in New Zealand, but billion-dollar budgets in the States, to crush this supposed problem.
Mm. Well, then cannabis is basically the ultimate I can violate your rights excuse, because so many people do it, you could bust anybody and just claim that they smelt cannabis or anything like that. You can't say, I claim to have smelt your ecstasy tablets.
Exactly. You can't say I've claimed to smell your stolen TV, you know, or whatever the case may be. But cannabis is a peach, you know, it's the low-hanging fruit because you can make up the pretense to search the person. And we've seen it a number of times in the past. Chris Fowley commendably defended himself against such an accusation made by a policeman who searched him and found cannabis, and he fought a tooth and nail in the courts, and the judge declared that he was innocent, or rather that the search was illegal, and his charges were dismissed, even though cannabis was found in him. So good going, Chris Fowley. Well done.
Well, yeah, I mean, it shows that basically there's no excuse across the board in any way, shape, or form for cannabis prohibition. Maybe arguments can be made about the other drugs, but that's not what we're focusing on here. It shouldn't be illegal. There is no moral justification. There is no legal justification. There is no ethical justification. There is no justification of any kind.
That's correct. These laws are based on lies. The initial drive to make cannabis illegal was all based on racism. It dates back to the 1912 Harrison Act. The first marijuana laws passed in the United States were in in Texas and California when they noticed that Mexicans were smoking marijuana. The term marijuana was actually introduced by Randall Hearst, but I'll get to that later. It was called cannabis in the United States up until the 1920s and 30s when this term was injected into the public lexicon.
Well, cannabis was everywhere. It was all over the recipe books. Everybody, medicines was made out of it.
Lemonade. It was an ingredient in lemonade. So you put cannabis leaves in your salad. Very healthy and tasty and non-psychoactive. So all of these other things that the plants were used for, they were being used, you know, all over the world. In fact, it was being grown on six continents. It's one of the hardiest plants on our planet. You don't need pesticides. You don't need fertilizers. You don't need much water to grow it. It grows in it even grows in irradiated soil around Chernobyl, where they're using it as a mop crop to get the radiation out of the ground. So here's a plant which you can grow practically anywhere for practically no investment and get a 50,000 different products from it, which you can either eat, which you can either make into medicines, which you can turn into textiles or building materials or fuel. Or paper, the best paper in the world, in fact. Paper that's lasted several hundred years longer than the paper that we currently produce
today.
Didn't
a dude also build a car out of it?
Henry Ford,
Not just Henry Ford. I know he built hemp and fueled it on hemp as mm-hmm, well. But mm-hmm. just more recently, a guy made a sports car and used hemp for the panel.
Yep, yes, that's right. It was in Drive magazine. Not just the paneling, the upholstery. There was the... I'm not exactly sure of the details, so I don't want to go into that. But getting back to Henry Ford's hemp car, practically the entire car was biodegradable. The body was six times lighter than steel and 10 times the tensile strength. So imagine if for the last 80 years we'd been driving around in cars made from cannabis, which the father of the modern automobile intended, we'd have... no pollution. I mean, well, we'd have a lot less pollution, definitely. I mean, with cars being fueled on carbon zero fuel, and also 1/6 the weight. So you need 1/6 the fuel to get the car around. So and the fuel can be locally produced. So you don't need to burn fuel to get the oil, which we're doing now, from the place where it's being extracted to the refinery to the pump. You can grow the cannabis locally, turn it into fuel locally, like you can do with lots of biofuels, and you can distribute it right there where it's being made.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
It is. And in a country like New Zealand, where you've got tracts of arable land which are currently being used to grow nothing or grass or things like corn, which we need less of, you could be growing hemp. And here's another interesting fact. Down in the northern part of Wellington, they are planting fields of cannabis, letting it grow for 3 months, harvesting the cannabis, processing the herd into building materials and building the house on site, so that there's no oil involved in transporting the building materials to the site. And there's no oil being burned in producing the building materials, which can be done by hand. So you can actually build a house which locks in carbon, right, without burning any fuel except maybe, you know, to bring people to the site, bring the workers to the site. Mm-hmm. And you have a house that is better than the house that you're living in now that's made from brick and mortar. It's insulated, self-insulating. The cannabis walls will eventually petrify and turn to stone. You can make the carpets out of it. You can make the paints out of it. You can make your furniture out of it. You can make an entire house out of cannabis, and you can make biofuels to cook with as well.
Everything methanol. Everything except the electrical appliances, basically.
Well, yeah, that's correct. You need to have those produced somewhere else, but you can run those off generators using cannabis-based methanol. So,
I wonder if you could build a generator out of hemp and run it on hemp fuel.
I would say that's almost possible. I would say you would need to have refined metals in that, but that basically you could make most of that generator out of cannabis, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it's basically the what Jack Harris said is that hemp could save the world. We've got so many problems, all of which not just some of which, but all of which can be solved with hemp. Okay, we've got corrupt politicians who won't listen. Smoke a joint. We've got cars that are real expensive to produce and basically weak. You know, they get smashed up every time, and it costs you huge amounts to repair them. Make them out of hemp. You've got all these pesticides and herbicides and things like that being sprayed all over your food and everything like that, and the soil's got no nutrients, and it grows some hemp in it, bro. It churns up the soil, makes everything a hell of a lot better. Every single thing that you point at, pretty much, that is in any way or shape or form a problem to our current society, from the radiation poisoning to the fuel shortages to the food shortages to the everything else shortages, the intellectual shortages, you know what I'm saying? Because I spoke to, it was a Bob Malamed, Dr. Bob Malamed, about this, and he says that society's basically turned into this the sort of war between what he calls backward-looking people and forward-looking people, or blips and flips. And he found out that endocannabinoids, cannabinoids from within, are actually some of the keystone to our evolution and actually facilitate higher thoughts, higher states of consciousness, and they regulate as well all the building blocks of our bodies. So it's good inside, it's good outside, in every way you can think of, and there's no justification to keep it illegal. Now, we keep running over that same ground. You know, why there's no justification, it's very good, etc. You know, it's been done to death. And yet, the motivation out there for people to stand up and just say, hey, no, and plenty of people do, yet the effect has not been quite as big as one might hope. Now, you were going back to racism. You know, the original reason why this drug was outlawed in the United States was racism.
That's absolutely true. You have the original drug czar, Harry Anslinger, making statements like the hot hay causes Negroes to rape white women, and to commit the offense of standing on a white man's shadow. That's an actual quote after they smoked marijuana. It was also the racism of Randall Hearst, who hated immigrants, absolutely hated immigrants, and hated the jazz movement. And there was this association between cannabis, which they called marijuana, and these people who they disliked. And it was very easy to then invent stories of murders, rapes being committed by these minority groups because they were under the effects of marijuana. And, it just so happens that Randall Hearst owned vast forestry concerns, and the wood pulp paper industry was one of the basis of his outrageous fortune, and it was being threatened by the new inventions that were being made in hemp production, so which would have then made better, cheaper paper. And, hemp is cannabis. People wouldn't be able to distinguish between the two if you just renamed it marijuana, which Anslinger and he did in the newspapers that he was releasing.
Well, so it's a Mexican nickname. Mari means Mary, and Juana means Jane.
And it wasn't even a popular Mexican slang term for it. They chose one that was really obscure so that people wouldn't know that they were talking about cannabis in these news releases. Everybody knew what cannabis was. It was in half the medicines at the turn of the century. There was huge tracts of hemp being grown, which they called cannabis hemp or hemp alternatively, in Missouri, in Kansas, in Arkansas,
Alabama,
Kentucky. There was something like 2,500 registered hemp plantations in 1910, and that's excluding the smaller farms. So there was cannabis all over the United States.
Well, cannabis is as American as apple pie, you know. What was his name? George Washington. He was a hemp farmer as well.
First four presidents were.
Had wooden teeth. He was smoking it. They analyzed his pipe. It's got marijuana residue in it.
He wrote about it in his journals, saying that the thing he loved most is sitting on his porch and smoking fine hemp in his pipe.
Now, how little things change over time. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Arik Reese is my guest, the maker of Drug Lord, the documentary at druglord.com.
Gentlemen, to the show that's all about drug dealing and organized crime, just like we do back home in Sicily at the Chateau de Rothschild. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And my very special guest, who knows intricately my very special business, Arik Reese, the maker of the documentary Drug Lord at druglord.com. Now, we're talking about pledges, right? Some people out there gotta buy a few of your DVDs in advance so that you can actually finish the film. Is that about right?
That's about right, Vinny. We've spent a lot of money on this film, and we still have a lot of money to spend, which we don't have. We're determined to finish regardless. But it would be very helpful if the folks out there would support us by going to www.druglord.com. You'll see a link to Pledge Me in our website. Click that link, and there you can make a pledge, which is basically an advanced order on our DVD or our merchandising, and that will support us in getting to the finish line here.
Okay. And then how long have you said you've been making this film for like the best part of 4 years?
Started it in August 2009.
Now, there's a documentary uploaded to my YouTube channel called, what was it, Time for Change New Zealand or something.
That was the first little shortcut that I released about this subject.
Yeah, and that was produced by Top Shelf Productions, I believe. And I remember visiting you at the studios there and seeing all this storyboarding and stuff all over the walls, huge quantities of work going into it. I think you were like working 70-hour weeks or something of that nature, getting that puppy together.
Yes, easily 70 hours a week. That lasted for several months. We got a huge budget from New Zealand On Air to produce this TV show, Inside New Zealand, High Time. It got Pick of the Week twice, when it was first released and when it was rerun. It was nominated for Pick of the Week by the TV Times. It told the story from the televisual perspective, which means you can't really take the stand that you want. You have to be sort of neutral to get it past the Broadcasting Standards Authority. So I determined then that I was going to re-release this whole thing as a feature-length documentary, which would be able to express the real issues without pandering to the kind of middle-class mediocrity which television has to do.
Well, can I ask then, do they have any ownership over the footage, concepts, ideas, and anything like that? You know,
no.
Sometimes there's stand-down periods for a number of years for filmmakers.
No. The deal that I organized was that I could reuse the footage for my own nefarious purposes.
Okay. Well, it's a nefarious purpose indeed. So, where exactly do we want to go from here? Because we've talked about the racism element, why it was made illegal by Harry Anslinger?
Jay Anslinger.
Isn't that interesting?
Jay. Who, incidentally, was a drug addict when he died, addicted to morphine painkillers. So the great drug warrior that established the system was a drug addict himself towards the end of his life.
Now, isn't that strange? Are you saying that somebody who lied to get a frivolous law instituted was also a hypocrite?
Wouldn't be the first time. So, I don't know at what age he was when he became a morphine addict, but he did die a morphine addict. So, you know, in the last 5, maybe 10 years of his life.
Yeah. Well, who knows? He could have been addicted to it the whole time and just keeping it under the radar.
You know? Well, you know, there's a high degree of alcoholism, which is drug use, legal drug use, amongst the drug warrior fraternity. They like their tipple. Richard Nixon enjoyed drink, was often, you know, imbibing his whiskeys in the White House and the Oval Office. So you've got drug use throughout, throughout the ranks of the drug warriors, whether it's legal or sometimes even illegal drugs. Mm-hmm. You've also got the same criminal activity that they're charging the rest of us with being committed on a hideous scale. But
it makes normal criminals and normal organized crime look like a child on a trike riding down the,
exactly,
on the wrong side
exactly.
of the road. You know, it's just nothing.
Exactly. Some people may recall, and this will be in the film, the first Bush 1, holding up a bag of crack cocaine and saying, "This is crack cocaine, and it's the worst thing ever." Well, it just so happens that the CIA, and this is in a book called Dark Alliance by Gary Webb, the CIA was running huge quantities of cocaine into Los Angeles.
While George H.W. Bush was the director of the
correct,
CIA.
Correct, exactly.
How do you think he got
time,
that bag to hold up?
Well, after the crack cocaine epidemic had been started, George Bush subsequently became president. But yes, you're right, Bush was the director of the CIA. So the guys who are peddling the drugs are also the same guys who are putting you in jail for using the drugs.
Yeah.
And profiting both ends. So
It's a massive conspiracy. I mean, there really is that element in there. And it's massive folds of it, like an onion. Isn't it interesting how one subject, like the laws on cannabis, can go into so many rabbit holes and open so many doors that it's virtually infinite? Is there a freaking end to this onion? You know, I don't know.
Well, the end to the onion, I think the onion is beginning to be peeled. Washington and Colorado states have legalized cannabis. The Department of Justice doesn't have the resources to crack down on all the mom-and-pop shops that are going to open up across those states and going to be turning over millions of dollars in taxes to the state revenue. So they cannot stop it. It's like a crack in the dam wall, and all they've got is their little child fist now because they've blown their budgets on trillion-dollar wars, and they've spent $1 trillion on the drug war so far, and they've been going backwards the whole time. And it's the dam wall's cracked, and the crack's going to open, and then the flood is going to come, and they're going to be washed away. And as soon as people realize, oh, wow, now we have legal cannabis, and the problems that we have in society related to this drug have actually decreased substantially, let's look at all these other drugs which they claim are so dangerous.
Mm.
So I think that what will happen is eventually you're going to have legalization of other drugs. It's not just going to stop at cannabis. And once that happens, you know, people are going to start questioning other things that they're being told, because this is one of the biggest lies. They've been perpetuating this lie for about 100 years now. And once it's exposed, they're going to start thinking, well, what else are we being lied to about?
Have you ever seen the movie The Mist?
I haven't.
No. Oh, it's a great film, and I was just thinking about this. You're talking about the crack in the dam wall and it all flooding over. Well, this movie, The Mist, there's this kind of military facility up on a mountain or whatever, and they open a gateway to another dimension, and all these creatures in the mist and stuff like that, and it just comes out and it just spills over everything. You know, I was just thinking like that, you know, suddenly cannabis is made legal, then the whole world just gets engulfed in this mist of smokiness that goes over and just chills everybody out. And say, man, what the hell are we worried about? Why are we arresting people? Why are we putting people in jail for life for possession of joints 3 times?
Yes, I think there will be that kind of spillover effect.
It's a brief period, if anything, you know, and eventually people get bored of it. And that's the lesson of the Netherlands. The amount of people that regularly used cannabis actually went down quite significantly, didn't it?
They had the lowest teenage use in the European Union. So we're here pounding on this drug about save the kids, protect the children, and meanwhile we're endangering the children at every step of this harm maximization policy that has been engineered by such narcocrats as Peter Dunne and Mike Sabin. They're making money out of it. They're getting reelected. Sabin's running his clinic, his rehab clinic, and his drug testing. It's a business for them. If you legalize cannabis, you've ripped out the vast majority of the business that they're doing right now.
Yeah.
What are they going to test for? How many people out there are doing heroin and going to work? And how easy is it to find the metabolites from heroin in their blood? It's easy to find the metabolites of marijuana, so you've got to keep it illegal because that's what you're making money out of, finding people who've smoked a joint maybe even 4 weeks ago or even 2 months ago, and you can find the metabolites in their blood still. So you've found them, you've caught them. Yay, yeah, we're doing something for society. We're catching the criminals. We're weeding out the you know, bad element. You know, and meanwhile, you can get absolutely pie-eyed drunk, come to work the next day, hungover. You won't be found out in your drug test, because they're not testing for alcohol. You won't be eliminated from your job because of use of an illegal drug. You can just carry on coming to work each day hungover, no problem.
And frequently people do.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And people frequently go to work high as well.
They do, and they function fine.
While operating heavy machinery sometimes.
Sometimes,
it's not recommended.
Well, sometimes better. I mean, some people need it to be able to concentrate. Some people find that it helps them function in their day-to-day life.
Well, this is another element. It has different effects, different strokes for different folks, horses for courses.
That's right.
I've seen some people without marijuana who are just terrible people, you know. They're, and it's not just their personality that gets terrible. It's when they're using alcohol, they just get violent and whatever. Yet you see them smoking and there's none of those negative effects, none of that aggression, none of that sort of BS about it. It's actually really safe for them. Other people, on the other hand, they freak out massively, and then they don't do it again. And it's pretty straightforward, you know. It's like, hey, you didn't die, you survived it, and now you'd realize that you're not one of those people who should be smoking.
That's right. There's a self-selection process when it comes to the use of this drug. You find that when people have negative reactions to it, they abstain, they don't use it. The idea that they use it once and then they're on the road to ruin, which eventuates in heroin addiction, that is one of the hugest myths of our time, and it was invented by the same Harry J. Anslinger. He is the father of the gateway theory.
The gateway theory of which everybody drinks alcohol, then takes drugs. We'll be right back. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure. Now, bear in mind that this show is pretty much 100% listener supported. If you are capable and you enjoy the platform that we give activists and researchers and various people from around the globe to get their messages out to people in a decent format, which is enjoyable, at least I think so, then please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and make a donation or subscribe for a couple of dollars a month, so that way we have a regular income of which to finance this wee operation here, which we are trying to expand every day in every single way. And also, speaking of pledging and donating and what have you, do you have a website or something of that nature, Eric, where people can go to pledge and get a DVD of the documentary?
Yes, we sure do. www.druglord.com. Go there, click on the Pledge Me link, or send us a message in the contact page. We'll get back to you. We'd appreciate the support. And if you're feeling really flush, you can get a principal sponsor credit in the film for $420 or $800 for an executive producer credit, and you will be enshrined in the halls of legend forever if you do so.
Right. Excellent. Enshrined in the halls of legend. Sounds biblical.
Well, cannabis is mentioned in the Bible, actually, in the Old Testament. You see the word kanebosem, which was mistranslated as calamus. It's obviously the word cannabis, cannabosim. When the Bible was translated and retranslated, they either made a mistake or there was a deliberate excision of the word cannabis. The early popes hated cannabis because they associated its use with their enemies and with paganism. So they had a little campaign against it, and they might have been responsible for this retranslation of the word.
And they were big drinkers of wine too, weren't they?
Yes. Again, the drug hypocrisy is enshrined in the Catholic Church. You know, Jesus turned water into wine.
And now, I think Jesus should have turned the apple tree into a massive cannabis plant or something like that, and suddenly everybody had salad.
Yes, he could have done that as well. It's interesting because some Bible scholars think that the holy anointing oil that was used to anoint Jesus, if you believe in Jesus, you know, that's a contentious subject, but if you do believe in it, well, it was likely that he was anointed with an oil containing cannabis. So, you know, Jesus used cannabis in one form or another. We don't know if he smoked it, but they were burning the oils in their ceremonies at that time. So they were getting high, even if it wasn't smoking it directly. They were getting secondhand highs from cannabis.
Okay. And weren't Bibles as well printed on hemp paper for
the very first Bible ever printed, the Gutenberg Bible, was printed on hemp paper. So there you go. Not only is cannabis in the Bible, cannabis is the Bible in some cases.
Yeah, well, it's good enough for Gutenberg. Why isn't it good enough for us?
Not only was it good enough for Gutenberg, that Bible still exists today because it was printed on such high-quality hemp paper. The scrolls of the ancient Chinese still exist today because they were printed on hemp rather than on what we use today, which is wood pulp paper, which has got a huge cost to the environment, and it's not even as good. So why are we still making paper out of trees? You can get four times the amount of paper out of the same land if you grow cannabis on that land instead of trees.
And you can harvest it multiple times a year.
Correct, and
well,
you're using a fraction of the water, the pesticides, and the herbicides.
Well, so let's extrapolate that. When you say that you can get four times as much paper out of land than you can with trees, does that... is that meaning that there's one crop of hemp versus a mature crop of trees, which takes 10 years to grow, one crop of hemp gets four times more paper?
No. What I'm saying is that because you can cycle cannabis on the land much more easily than trees, and its life cycle is much shorter, it's the fastest growing biomass on the planet, or one of the fastest growing biomasses. It simply means you can harvest it four times as often, or I'm not sure the exact number, but the amount of product that you can get from that land to make the paper will give you four times as much paper as if you plant trees.
Over a time frame. So for when you're planting the trees, you've got a 10-year waiting period before you even get any money back.
That's right.
A storm might happen and blow a whole bunch of them down, or there might be some kind of a forest fire, or there might be droughts or whatever. I wonder if an entire massive crop of cannabis has ever really been affected by a forest fire or anything like that. The only times I've ever seen like mass burn-offs and things like that is up north when they confiscate massive crops, and you see the, I believe there was a news reporter standing in front of it and the smoke was wafting over him, and it was a blooper reel or something like that.
He started laughing
and he kept losing his place and stuff like that, trying to be professional.
Yes. Interesting that when they burn these crops, they all stand around and take deep breaths. You know, the police are often doing that. They're just enjoying the high let them. I say, well, enjoy it. At least you kind of get to be happy for that little period of your time policing this plant. You know, you're trying your best. You might be misguided, but you're trying your best.
Yeah. A friend of mine was telling me back in high school that he was watching a bunch of cops sitting there, and they just kind of slumped to the side very gently as they're standing around these big roaring fires of cannabis smoke. So, again, the hypocrisy. He was even pulled over one time, and a cop was rolling a cigarette, like with the normal cigarette papers and what have you, and there was cardboard ripped out of the cigarette papers, like people do when they're rolling their cardboard for the end of their joints and something like that. So it was very clear to him that this officer was a cannabis user, confiscated an ounce off him, didn't charge him, and just let him go.
Oh, yes.
He went right home with that ounce, didn't
yes.
he?
Oh, yes. Listen, in South Africa, I was walking down the street with my friend Ralph. These two cops, they had these yellow police cars there, or they had them at this stage. I haven't been there for a while, so I don't know what the cop cars look like now, but this yellow car pulls up, cops jump out, they start talking to us, they search Ralph, they take his weed, they drive off, they don't charge us, they don't really hassle us, they just take the weed. Carry on walking, and we see them parked down the road, smoking a fucking joint. Smoking, no.
FCC regulations.
FCC regulations.
I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen.
You know how that. I didn't actually say it. I stopped myself at that last second. But anyway. So there you go. There you go. Policemen smoke weed probably as much as the general population. So and they have access to it. They have free access to it. They can just take it off you. They don't have to pay for it.
Now, see. And what stoner is going to go to the police station and say, these officers took my weed and they didn't charge me? Where is that weed? Where is the evidence? The officer will just say, no, we never stopped them. This kid's just making it up. And then a person will file a police complaint to the police complaints authority, and the other cops will just do nothing.
Well, I would like to see the drug testing be extended to the police force. I would like to see exactly how many of them are going to be stood down when they've found when cannabinoids are found in their blood, and how the police force will grind to a halt. Because I reckon there's probably between 5 or 10% of people in the police force who indulge in some illicit drug use. So let's campaign to have the police force drug tested. If they want drug testing for the general population, or if the Mike Sabins of the world and Peter Dunns of the world think drug testing is fair to be forced on the rest of us, well, let's put that drug testing on the police as well.
Well, yeah, I think if you're going to test anybody, test the people who are the enforcers of the law first and the people who break the law second. Because, hey, you can't have corruption and hypocrisy running through a government, can you, if you're wanting to keep the public safe, if that's what they allege that they're doing, when they're frickin' not. Making it all worse.
Well, the main cause of corruption in the police force is the drug laws. I've spent a lot of hours in court during the production of this film, and I've met a lot of people who are up on drug charges. And I've heard stories of bags of methamphetamine being taken by the police and not registered in the evidence registry. That meth was just sold or used or what have you. I've heard of bags of drug money being taken by the police, not reported, that money was stolen. Two cases of that, including dear old great-grandmother in Pyro, who had about $300 or $400 pinched by the police. Her charges were embellished. The police lie regularly to get a drug charge to stick. And it's accepted. It's accepted practice. We have Timothy Serra, police prosecutor, found guilty of dealing methamphetamine from the courthouse, between sessions in court. Police prosecutors are selling methamphetamine that's been confiscated from crime scenes. What a racket.
Now, I also heard that the police have an intimate relationship with drugs and the gangs themselves. Do you have any evidence of that?
I've reason to believe that the raids on the Daiquiri were preempted by the police sending in gang members to cause trouble. That it seems that the police have instigated the pretext to raid the Daiquiri. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's the Daiquiri, because I'd heard stories that the police would confiscate drugs from one gang and then go across the road and sell it to the other.
It's happened before. It wouldn't surprise me. Look, I'm not saying that all policemen are corrupt. But what other opportunities do the ones who are prone to corruption have to exercise that corruption if you take the drug scene out of it? They don't really have. What can you do? You resell a stolen TV.
Yeah, I mean,
there's no money in it.
we're like taking the cookies out of the cupboard of a compulsive eater, essentially, right? There ain't nothing to compulsively eat if there ain't nothing to eat.
That's right. I mean, you can't really engage in corrupt activity in a murder case, in a rape case, in an assault case, in any number of cases that you can think of. There's no opportunity.
Unless you committed them and take steps to cover it up.
Okay, aside from covering up, but you're not going to be able to profit from it. The only real instance where you can profit from a crime is if drugs are involved and you take the money or you take the drugs, you resell, you pass it on, you give it to Timothy Serra to resell or pass it on. So it's the opportunity that the drug laws present for corruption to occur in the police force. The main problem with our police force today.
You believe that's the main problem with the police force today?
It's, well, with regards to corruption, yes. I mean, the
certainly in the most widespread.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Both here and in almost any other country where drugs are illegal, which is everywhere.
Yeah, and hey, as we just demonstrated, everybody's got a story of police lying or being corrupt or something like that. I remember when I was arrested, they found 13 grams of cannabis on me, and they charged me with selling up to $40,000 worth of cannabis.
You were charged?
Oh, yeah. I was convicted too, man. I pled guilty and got 300 hours community service. The guy in front of me who was up for sexual assault, resisting arrest, growing 3 cannabis plants, got 150 hours community service. Explain that one to me.
Well, the logic is that if you beat someone over the head, it's a lesser crime than if you snub your nose at authority by growing a plant or possessing the dried flowers of that plant. That's the so-called logic.
It was an indictable charge for me. I was going to go to jail. I could have gone to jail for up to 8 years.
So they embellished 13 grams into $40,000.
Uh-huh.
Yes, this
because I admitted that I'd been selling for so many months. You know, I was just totally naive at the time. And so they said, oh, well, he must have been selling an ounce a week, and then therefore, and then just so on and so forth, $40,000.
Yes, yes, the classic embellishments. One of the police tricks is to take a plant that's in a pot and to measure it from the ground, including the pot, to the top, to say that the plant is an extra 25 or 35 centimeters in height. Therefore, it has a street value of X plus 35 centimeters,
yeah.
And you can then up the amount, and then of course each plant is a street value according to the police of, you know, an exponentially greater amount than its real street value. They just compound all of these numbers and they embellish the charge against you just to wreck your life a little bit more.
Well, I think it's more to get people to plead guilty to lesser charges if they make up much more massive charges. And they say, well, if you plead guilty to this charge, which you're actually guilty of, we'll drop these charges which we made up.
That's right, which brings us to the case of Stephen McIntyre. He was a cannabis activist who founded a medical dispensary to help people with severe illnesses that can only be treated by cannabis or ameliorated by cannabis. The police arrested him. They harassed him mercilessly. They threatened him to drum up the charges, and if he didn't plead guilty, they kept putting pressure on him. They came to his house claiming to be checking on his bail conditions when he wasn't required to be at the house at that time, so that was another lie. And eventually the pressure got too much for him and he committed suicide. So this was a personal friend of mine, very gentle guy, lovely man, who's now dead. His children have no father, his wife has no husband, and the police have his blood on their hands. And this is happening every day in New Zealand. I've met people during the course of making this documentary, one girl whose uncle owned a cannabis cafe in the Netherlands, came back to visit his family, was arrested for a small amount of cannabis, put in a cell, had an epileptic fit, and died. So, for what? What were the police imprisoning that man for? What was he doing to anybody else? Absolutely nothing. He had some dried flowers in his pocket.
Did he deserve to die?
Definitely didn't deserve to die. He didn't deserve anything. He didn't deserve to be scolded. He didn't deserve, you know, he didn't deserve any kind of punishment whatsoever. He certainly didn't deserve to lose his life. And his family certainly didn't deserve his life to be taken from them.
See, you do realize that the drugs don't kill people, drug laws kill people.
Absolutely.
And enforcement of the like. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. A very special guest, Arik Reese from druglord.com. That's law with a W. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
The flight to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. Have your dessert, you prick. Give me that dessert. Have a Bloody Mary. Yeah, give me a whiskey sour. Yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor, more liquor, more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go. You want to know what it's like, you can experience going to New Zealand. It's very simple. Sit in a chair for 19 hours and take your hands and press your head as hard as you can. And don't stop. Don't stop. 19 hours, just like this. And then at the end of 19 hours, you pull your hands off and you feel like you're in New Zealand. You certainly won't feel like you're home. They say that New Zealand's beautiful, and I don't know, because by the time I got over the jet lag, I had to go. And it seems to me, if you're going to travel for 19 hours to another country, when you get there, they should have the common courtesy to speak another language. I did not fly all this way to hear English again.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Arik Reese from druglord.com. That's law, you know, ED, druglord.com. Now, there's a Pledge Me thingy on there, ladies and gentlemen, so if you can help him finish his film, get it out to people. I've seen what he managed to do with the High Time New Zealand documentary. And I remember saying to you at the time, it's like, oh, man, they made you butcher it. Oh, you know, it's so one way or the other, and it's so iffy, and there's things in there that just like, what are you trying to do? Balance the equation with yeah. Misconception? It's just like, oh, my God, you poor bastard. And now this is going to be like, in my opinion, probably the best freaking cannabis documentary that's been made in like a decade.
I don't recall any significant documentaries being made on cannabis except for the TV3 documentary that I made back in 2010. There's been some, you know, smallish kind of TV coverage on Maori TV about it, but it hasn't really been a significant investigation. We are looking at the entire world when we look at this documentary and the microcosm that New Zealand presents, because the same laws that are in this country have been imposed by the United States on almost every country on the planet. And those laws are causing an incredible amount of harm. And they're suppressing the production of a plant that can do an incredible amount of good. So, you know, the costs to society of the prohibition of cannabis are enormous. And we need to really get past this childish, racist, anachronistic disposition against this plant. We need to grow up and realize that for 12,000 years almost, human beings have been benefiting from this plant, and it's only in the past 100 years there's been this prohibition of the plant, which has caused all of these problems, and we need to get back to what we were doing for those 12,000 years.
Mm. Yeah, it reminds me, I think my uncle was really drunk one night and scabbed a cigarette off me, and proceeded to tell me that I'll never amount to anything and nobody ever amounts to anything if they use cannabis, that it's only for losers while drunk as frack.
Smoking the cigarette, exactly. Addicted to the two drugs of choice in Western society.
Have you ever seen Trainspotting, you know, in the start, it's like, oh, I don't do heroin. It's foreign fucking chemicals, you know, as he sculls back a beer and takes a puff of a cigarette, you know?
Exactly. You know, the drug hypocrisy that we've got in Western society has spread, unfortunately, to all of these societies in Asia, in Africa, South America more recently, which have been using cannabis for a longish or very long period of time, and now cannabis is being displaced. In India, it's being displaced by the use of alcohol, especially in the north of India, and alcohol is causing all kinds of problems in society. Meanwhile, the kind of shunty attitude of the cannabis user is being shunned. You know, it's being suppressed. There's widespread crop burnings, and it's not just crops being planted for recreational medicinal purposes or industrial purposes, it's crops being planted for food. So you've got this, the impact of cannabis prohibition on people's livelihood in that way. Some people are starving in Nepal because their crops are being eradicated by UN drug programs. UNESCO and so forth are in there and destroying their food, you know, so that the U.S. can say, rah, rah, our cannabis prohibition is worldwide, and so we're going to destroy this plant in any country that we find it, regardless of your sovereign rights in that country.
Yeah, and that's another thing. Not only does the – oh, sorry, let me rephrase. Not only do the laws inherently give a justification to deprive individuals of their rights, but through the United Nations, it actually globally violates national sovereignty.
Absolutely, absolutely. The conventions on drugs that most countries are signatories to take away the power of those countries to organize their laws and their policies in a way that suits those countries' needs and has the most positive outcomes. So sovereignty has been flushed down the toilet by signing these conventions, and it's extremely difficult for countries to step back and go, hang on a second, we need to there's a process where you can withdraw from a convention and re-sign with conditions. And in order to find the political will for a parliament of any country, including New Zealand, to do that, it's extremely difficult. So we're in lockstep with these stupid United Nations policies.
Well, there has been was it Raglan or some other small New Zealand town who says that they wanted to start a campaign there on a small scale to legalize using a local ordinance, and that would basically crack open the door. Just kind of like, if you want something to get really big, you got to start small.
Yes, no, I know which. It was a place in the South Island. I'm sorry, I'm not sure exactly what the town is called, where one of the local councillors was pushing for this. But it's not going to find a lot of traction. There's too many conservative people in the local city councils in this country to have the foresight to realize, well, there are ways that you can do it. They did it in the Netherlands. They had the tolerance policy. They still have it to this day, where the police were told, just turn a blind eye. It's still against the law. Look the other way because it's not a problem. And then they found that not only was it not a problem, it was actually a boon. They have tourism there because of it. They have, I don't know, millions? I could say millions of people visiting every year.
Well, there's 1 million annually from France alone.
Visiting the Netherlands.
Specifically.
To visit the coffee shops.
That's a tourism boom by any stretch of the imagination. And then you think about the proximity, how many other countries are within there that are easily travelable by train. Mm-hmm. Now with the European zone, you don't even need to have passports and things checked. You just roll right in and then roll right up.
Right. And the problem associated with this is that people are going there to score and then transporting it back to their own countries. And they're being arrested for that, and fair enough. Fair enough, you're taking it across national borders and you shouldn't be doing that.
That's drug trafficking.
Exactly. So I don't mind people being punished for doing stupid things with cannabis, right? If you sell to somebody who's underage, you deserve to go to jail. So the problem there, though, is that you can't get it in Germany legally. You can't get it in France legally. You have to go to the Netherlands to get it. So if they were to legalize in France and in Germany, that problem would disappear.
Yeah, there would be no drug trafficking over the borders for those particular people that are currently being caught for it. And also, on the other hand, I've heard that the tourism boom in the Netherlands is so strong because of this that they're actually experiencing problems because of the huge amount of tourists that they're coming in and certain people being disrespectful.
That's right.
Defecating in the street and so on and so forth.
Well,
I'm not sure if that's to do with the cannabis, though, you know. Cannabis doesn't make me want to squat in the street.
No, although I have seen people do that on alcohol. What happens is you get the dregs of society that are going to get on this bandwagon and go there for the party, right? But like I just said, if they could get cannabis in their own country, they'd be the dregs of society in their country, which they're doing anyway. You know, so at least they'd be defecating in the streets of their hometown rather than going to a foreign country to do it.
Yeah, I know. And so those are the dregs of society that have enough money for a plane ticket.
Plane ticket or ferry ticket or however they train ticket if they're coming from France or Germany. You know, the cost of travel, I'm not sure how much it is to get across borders in the European Union these days.
Well, just jump on a train as far as I know.
Yeah, you could get a passage pretty easily. So they're arriving in the Netherlands and they're causing problems, and then people are pointing at that and going, look at the problems caused by, you know, having legal access to cannabis. No, that's the problems caused by not having legal access to cannabis in your own country.
Yeah.
They're coming here and causing problems, you know. And if you had legal access in your own country, you could divert funds to treat those people who do have a problem, and then there'd be less of a problem.
See, and it's coming back to that same old broken record again. The prohibition doesn't work, and even when you legalize in a prohibitionist world, it still is not perfect. You know,
of course not.
Global legalization, ultimately, that'd be the ideal goal of this film, wouldn't it?
Well, of course. The objective of the film is to bring about a change in New Zealand policy and even globally, because people in other countries will see that New Zealand is a representative of their country and falls neatly within the framework of the United Nations imposing its prohibition on their country. Mm. And if people in New Zealand take the lead like they claim they did, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when New Zealand was possibly a progressive society, if they could take that mantle upon themselves again and get rid of politicians like Peter Dunn and get rid of power players like Mike Sabin and have people who are talking sense like Matiria Ture decide our drug policies with our best interests at heart rather than their own interests at heart, we could take the lead and we could show other countries that this is how you regulate cannabis. This is how you control this thing.
Mm.
This is how you cause it, you take it from being a problem to being something that's beneficial for society, that can generate income, that can help people with sickness, and that can give people a safer alternative to alcohol, which is the main drug problem in this country.
I heard a statistic, I believe the government even advertises the statistic on TV. Is it 79% of all weekend crime is related to alcohol?
85%.
85%
was the statistic that I read. 85%. In the United States, not talking about weekend crime, but talking about crime in general, 30% of crimes are committed under the influence of alcohol. In New Zealand, if you're not talking about the weekend, if you're talking about the whole week, it's 40% of crimes. And this is the whopper. In the UK, 80% of crimes are committed under the influence of alcohol in the United Kingdom.
80%?
So tell us what the problem drugs are, drug warriors. And then you have Peter Dunn, who not only represents the tobacco industry in the cases that I've looked at where he's been voting in their favor. He's also representing the alcohol industry. He quashed that inquiry that was recently... He withdrew the $10,000, the measly $10,000 funding that they required to finish their study. He denied them that, so the study was never completed. And the Law Commission's advocation for tightening of the alcohol laws was basically watered down to become almost insignificant. So the booze barons are just laughing. They've got it their way almost every step of the way. And we're asking for what we're asking for in comparison is that cannabis be regulated without any advertising, right? Look at how much advertising the liquor industry sponsors. You know, aren't they sponsoring the All Blacks? They're sponsoring numerous rugby teams.
They sponsored frickin' James Bond.
Did they? Well, there you go. The alcohol industry has proliferated right through the society. We've got some of the highest rates of alcohol abuse in this country in the world. You see it in the newspaper every day. Speaking of the All Blacks, Robin Brooks sexually assaulting a teenage girl and her teenage friend, and on holiday. You know, you've got Zac Efron. What's his name? The young All Black, alcoholic, assaulting people for no reason because he's drunk. You know, this is happening all the time. You open the newspaper and there's an All Black who's committed an assault while drunk. So these are supposed to be, you know, the prime examples of, you know, New Zealand achievement, the All Blacks. Yeah, go the All Blacks. Go and assault somebody while you're drunk. Thanks very much, eh? Raise the profile of the All Blacks.
Yeah, well, it seems that alcohol is just a very massive problem in this country and many others. And it occurs to me as well, you know, what was it? There was something funny I heard the other day. Oh, yeah. It was like 65% of women surveyed think that the Prime Minister of New Zealand, John Key, is sexy. And a lot of people thought, well, that's very interesting. You know, for me, it just highlighted the drinking problem that we've got in this country.
Yes, indeed. You'd have to be pretty drunk. You'd have to be pretty beer-goggled to think that the Prime Minister is sexy. He's not a sexy man.
You know, he's just got a big poster of him on the wall, and I'm just
staring
looking
at him.
You know, and he's staring at, you know, his eyes follow you wherever you
go. That's true.
You know, it's just like on Ghostbusters 2 with that painting of that old warlord dude that was real freaky and just kind of followed you around and stuff like that. That's like John Key on your wall, bro. It's pretty disturbing.
It is disturbing.
You know, and I was just thinking about this. These people are just freaking criminals in suits. They're running the drugs. They're taking the drugs. And their inherent hypocrisy is, we're the ones who should be punished, we're the ones who should be surveilled, we're the ones who should be busted, we're the ones who should be thrown in jail, we're the ones who should be killed, we're the ones who should have our lives destroyed by their policy, which they made up off the top of their frickin' head to protect their own scumbaggery interests. They're criminals in suits. They're in parliament, they're in the government buildings, they're on the streets selling you frickin' drugs. From the courthouse between sessions. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back after the break at The Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Divided we fall. Unity, please don't desert me. No one's gonna take me alive. It's time who's come to me. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live 5 days a week at AmericanFreedomRadio.com, 5 till 7 Central, 6 till 8 p.m. Eastern, 11 till 1 a.m. in the morning GMT time, which I believe is midnight till 2 a.m. in the European Union. And in New Zealand, the time zone switch from periodic times, you know, when we have daylight savings and what have you. At the moment, during the dead of winter, it's 10 a.m. through midday, Tuesday through Saturday. So if you are capable of listening live, I implore you, please do, and do so daily, because this show will inform you about lots and lots and lots and lots of different things. This is just one show, and we're talking about cannabis, and we're uploading copious quantities of videos and things of that nature every single day. We're making sure that issues really get understood in their entire holistic nature, because nothing exists in a vacuum, nor is any man an island, as they say. This cannabis issue ties into so many, and cannabis by itself, the topic, we were talking about this over the break, Eric, is that cannabis is not technically addictive, but the study of the drug laws and the study of cannabis itself surely can be.
Well, I found that myself. My interest in the subject was pretty negligible until I started looking at it in detail, and then 4 or 5 years down the line, I've got a library full of books about hemp and cannabis. I've watched 50 to 100, I don't know how many, documentaries about cannabis. I've discovered more and more on the internet all the time. It's a fascinating subject. There's so many angles that you can approach it from. Even if you have no interest in ever consuming the drug yourself, you might be thinking about building your house out of it. you know, which we're doing now, finally in New Zealand, that little technology which has been around for hundreds of years, and they've been doing in France, even though there was a prohibition, they continue to build houses out of cannabis in France in spite of the US effort to stop that. That technology has been taken up here in New Zealand, and people are now building their house with cannabis.
Okay. It can feed you, it can clothe you, it can heal you, and it can set your mind free.
Certainly can. What do you want to talk about?
You know, I think we've kind of we've covered the subject with immense scope here. I was wondering, is there anything that we have not covered?
There are thousands of things we haven't covered. We haven't really talked about the alternative uses of cannabis. We haven't really touched upon the mystical uses of cannabis.
Let's go into the mystical uses.
Sure. Well, let's look at the sadhus in India who consume insane quantities of cannabis to reach these states of siddhartha or whatever you want to call it. It's odd that these guys who are consuming this supposedly deadly toxic drug seem to live longer than the average person. I mean, some of them are into their 90s, the ones that I've read about. So if the drug was so deadly and they're consuming 25, 30 chillums in a row, why aren't they exhibiting any health problems from the consumption of this drug? It's because it's not toxic. That's why. I'll answer that question for you. It is a non-toxic substance. If it were toxic, it wouldn't be present in your mother's milk. It's present in breast milk. It's present in your body whether you've ever consumed the drug. You've got an endocannabinoid system. Why would your body be naturally producing exactly the same molecule inside your body if it were toxic?
Now, it's a transmutable molecule as well, isn't it? Like, it has so many different functions that it can fulfill. If you need, say, a disease to be killed or something, mm-hmm, it kills mm-hmm. it. If you need cell regeneration, like after an injury or something like that, a reduction in inflammation, it does it. It's almost like it's an intelligent being that, when imbibed, seeks out what it can improve or heal.
Well, I don't want to commit to that line of argument, but I will concur with what you said. It does seem to do what you want it to do. If you have MS, it will do it will ameliorate the condition. If you have Tourette's syndrome, it will ameliorate the condition.
Our mutual mate Barry, he's got MS.
That's
correct. And I remember we were walking up Queen Street, and I walk reasonably fast because I've got really long legs, right? And I was just cutting right ahead of him so easily, and I actually had to slow down significantly for him. And then he had a joint, and I had to run to catch up with him.
That's right. And not only that, but if we were to regulate cannabis and allow growers to differentiate between the strains that certain symptoms can be treated best with, we'd have much better outcomes than what we currently use. Currently, people with MS, they just buy what they can, and they usually buy, you know, shady dealers who they can't trust and who may have adulterated the plant with something else to make it look more have a higher quality and a higher price. You know, there's the reports of glass and things like that being added, you know, things to make it look crystalline. So that's thanks to the prohibition. If you could walk into a dispensary, as you can now in 18 states in the United States and in about two dozen different countries in the world, and say, I have the following symptoms, please can I have the cannabis which will give me energy if you're low in energy, or help me sleep if you have insomnia, or promote your appetite if you have AIDS wasting syndrome. And they can give you a strain that is most likely to help you, and you can experiment with the various strains to find the one that treats the problem that you have. Currently, we can't do that.
It's just dumb luck at this point.
Yeah. You might find that the shady dealer that you're going to has the right strain 1 week, and he doesn't have it the next week because maybe his supplier just got raided by the police. So, you know, for the people who really need it, where it's not a case of I just want to use it recreationally, those people are being affected the most, and they're the most vulnerable members of our society. not only are they being deprived of access to their medicine, but they're often being deprived of their freedom. They're being deprived of their livelihood. They're being deprived of their assets. They're being deprived of their scholarships, of their jobs, contact with their family, you know, the trust of their neighbors. The list goes on. There's so many costs that are imposed on cannabis users in this country, and so many costs imposed on non-cannabis users who are footing the bill to keep this ridiculous farce going.
Now, throughout history, the Spanish, I believe, wiped out a large number of people who were, say, using mushrooms and other hallucinogens when they came into South America in order to impose their own religion upon mm-hmm. people in order to destroy the local religion. Is there a religion that's cannabis-related?
There are some religions that are based on the use of cannabis. Rastafarianism is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
In India, the sadhus, there is a lot of transcendental use of cannabis in Asia. Africa, less so. I know that that certain sangomas, certain practitioners of African healing arts in Africa use cannabis. It's called dacha there, or isango is the the Zulu term for it. And it's part of their tradition, and it's been heavily suppressed. You know, South Africa still has the same kind of cannabis prohibitionist mentality that's been inculcated. In fact, here's an interesting story, speaking of racism, and it's actually the historically racist South Africans that were the first ones to suggest to the League of Nations that cannabis be banned because they noticed that it was causing the Hottentots to rebel against their white masters, but they made provisos that the mine workers could use it because it seemed to increase their productivity. So you've got the hypocrisy going through at every level, and it's thanks to the racist South Africans 100 years ago that the first cannabis laws were passed, the opium treaties. Cannabis got bundled into that, into the early opium conventions, thanks to the racist South Africans.
Well, isn't that lovely?
Donkey say Africa!
Mm-hmm. It sounds about the right, mate.
Yeah.
Mm. I don't think these people who are in these positions of power really have any feeling for consequence of their actions. I mean, if I were responsible for an ill person being deprived of, say, their job or their home or perhaps deprived of their very life itself, if they died, because of my actions, I would feel intense guilt about it and immediately reverse myself. If I were to instead go up to one of these current prohibitionists, tell them these stories, there's nothing.
You get a blank stare. You know, Peter Dunn was, when he shot down the medical amendments that was being pushed by the Green Party a couple of years back, he said a yes on this vote would mean greater access to the leaf to everyone. So no support. No, it doesn't mean greater access to anyone because people couldn't get more access to the plant right now. Anybody who wants it can get it, okay? That's number one. And number two, no, what you're doing is you're giving a little bit of protection to the people who need it for their illness. And you're not talking about the rest of society. This is a medical bill that was being voted on. And he shot it down without blinking an eyelid. I don't think he has the capacity for empathy to recognize how much suffering he's actually caused and is still causing.
He's a freaking psychopath. That's basically my assessment of the situation.
Sociopaths in suits are the people most likely to ascend to positions of power.
Yeah, well, it's because they sabotage their competition and propel themselves forward while all the good people get left out in the cold to die. Thank you, Eric, for coming on the show with me today.
It's been a pleasure.
Druglord.com is the website, ladies and gentlemen. Please make a pledge and get him some of the funding that he needs to finish the film. We'll see you again sometime, folks.
Thanks for having me.